From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, the three-day weekend is behind us, and the state capitol is back to business. State lawmakers will resume floor sessions this afternoon, as well as committee hearings this week. There are, of course, some big obstacles to overcome, from a looming state budget shortfall that needs to be balanced and passed in a little over 2 weeks, and, of course, the influence of California's leaders on the upcoming presidential election. Here to get us up to speed is someone who is always tapped in. Dustin Gardner is co-author of Politico's California Playbook and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As always, thanks for joining us, Dustin. Okay, so state lawmakers, they need to close an estimated or projected $31 billion budget shortfall, a projection that comes from the governor's office. And it's been just over 2 weeks since the May revise, which really is a draft, because now is that crunch time for negotiations and lobbying about what and how much to cut. So what stands out to you about the deals that are taking place?
Yeah, well, the biggie that came out this morning, my colleague Blake Jones reported for Politico that there's a deal between the governor and CTA, the California Teachers Union. And this is really about his plans around education funding. The governor had put out a proposal to delay some cuts around school funding. And he reached this new deal with the teachers union where the state can alleviate some of that and pay schools about an additional $5.5 billion in future years. And this comes after there was a rare rift between Newsom and the teachers union. They've long been one of his biggest allies, and the teachers union had been pretty critical about his earlier proposal to essentially borrow money to prevent some cuts to state education. They said that they felt like that approach, some of them were concerned that approach was effectively delaying cuts, not preventing them. So now Newsom has put out a plan that is more in line with what the union is hoping for to avert some of that pain potentially down the road. So that's one biggie. And then also, you know, we've seen the governor outline a lot of different accounting maneuvers to help close the gap. In his May revise, a huge portion of the gap is being solved by doing things like delaying the last payday for state employees into the next fiscal year. So the next paycheck will be July 1st rather than the end of June. So that saves the state a couple of billion. And there's a lot of maneuvers that are kind of along those lines of helping to delay the pain. But again, there are some pretty tough cuts in here. The governor had to take a big whack to a lot of state climate programs, especially in hundreds of millions cut for incentives for electric vehicles, a lot of money cut for other pollution reduction programs. So now we're kind of in the thick of budget negotiations between the governor and the legislature and seeing where exactly all of his proposed cuts land. And he's dealing with two new classes of leadership in the chambers. And the next 6 weeks or so will be a really interesting time to see how that all shakes out.
Well, the California Teachers Association is a good example that pressure works when it's implemented. You mentioned that the CTA, you know, they're big allies of the governor, and this was a rare rift. What kind of pressure took place for really to shave off what was going to be $12 billion in cuts over 2 years?
Yeah, so there was a whole ad campaign that the teachers released. There were social media ads calling out the governor and, you know, really putting him under the microscope from one of his closest unions. They were criticizing this proposed $12 billion in cuts. And this ad really needled the governor about that spending proposal. And it was a rare intense campaign where you see CTA, one of the governor's closest allies, kind of backing him into a corner a bit there.
So given that state lawmakers have to pass a balanced budget by June 15th, that's just over 2 weeks from now, or they don't get paid, how confident are you that that will happen?
It seems like, you know, it is usually pretty typical that the legislature will eke out some sort of a deal to make sure that they get paid. Where, you know, they can make procedural maneuvers where they'll pass placeholder budget trailer bills. I think, you know, so often some of the big scaffolding can be in place, and then they can take a couple weeks longer or sometimes a couple months longer to really finish out the details, which would come in the form of a budget trailer bill, which is essentially a follow-up bill amending the earlier budget bill to make tweaks around the specifics. So I think Yeah, I think we'll see the broad strokes of a detail. The lawmakers never want to go without pay. I haven't seen a year where that where that's happened. Yeah, but I think this could be another year, just given the complexity of that budget deficit, the $31 billion. I think this could be another year where they do finish filling in the details well after that June deadline.
Am I correct in that? Okay, the $31.5 billion that's projected as a deficit, this follows the early budget shortfall action that took place, I think, in April, which shaved off like $17 billion.
So the way I understand the math, so the early budget action took about $17 billion of deficit off the table. And we're now looking at about, after that early budget action, we're looking at about $27 billion that has not been addressed. And that's, yeah, so that is with the early action taken into account. The legislature has not acted on every piece of that early action proposal, but there is a tentative agreement between the governor's office and lawmakers about doing those things. And so, yeah, we're looking at roughly that $27 billion on the table to still address.
All right. Well, moving on to the presidential race, we're only less than 6 months ago, actually. And one of the biggest motivating issues in this year's general election, of course, is abortion. California has long been involved with driving that message home across the country when it comes to reproductive rights, especially Governor Gavin Newsom, even Vice President Kamala Harris. What are some of the latest efforts?
Yeah, we've really seen the governor and the vice president hit the road all over the country campaigning for Joe Biden on the abortion issue. Governor Newsom has taken out ads in red states like Alabama and Tennessee, really trying to put Republicans on the defensive around abortion. He's calling out those states for doing things like criminalizing people that that help minors obtain abortions out of state. He's had billboards in Florida and Texas criticizing those states over their stringent abortion laws. And then just last week, the governor signed a law to help Arizona doctors get licensed temporarily in California so they can treat their patients across state lines. And that followed in the wake of all the drama in Arizona about the state's 1864 abortion ban being upheld by the state Supreme Court and then overturned by the legislature there. So really, Governor Newsom has been kind of waging a tactical campaign against Republicans all across the country around abortion. And putting them on the defensive. And then the vice president has been doing the same. She's been on her reproductive freedom rights tour for many months. And she's spent a lot of time in battleground states like Nevada and Arizona, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. But really, it's been an interesting moment because Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom, both discussed as future potential presidential contenders. So this is really an opportunity for them to build their national profiles and to speak to new audiences and to call out former President Donald Trump and, kind of make themselves a foil to Trump and Republicans on the abortion issue.
Yeah, I was going to ask because they're both going at this issue and they're not the only political leaders that are doing that. But does it look like Governor Newsom and Vice President Harris are in lockstep, or because of these potential political aspirations in the years to come, are they competing with each other?
That's a really interesting question. The two of them, they both came up through San Francisco politics. They had a lot of the same donors and mentors over the years. And so you would think that there traditionally had been a rivalry between Newsom and Kamala Harris because of that. But everything I have seen seems to be the opposite. There seems to be a genuine friendship there. I think the two of them do have a personal connection just from all their years working in San Francisco politics and then state politics together. So I think, yeah, we haven't really seen much of a divergence there, but they are competing for the same pool of people if they both decide to run for president down the road, if they're both running in 2028. So it'll be interesting to watch, but so far I really haven't seen a divergence. Mm-hmm. And they both seem to be very disciplined in terms of being on message and promoting Joe Biden in this campaign. But again, yeah, we'll watch and see how that shakes out down the road.
Well, across the aisle, California Playbook reported last week that the main Republican super PAC for House races, it's putting $30 million into ad buys focused on California ahead of the November general election. We do have purple districts. We do have swing districts. Which districts are they targeting?
Yeah, so there's a handful of swing districts in California that really could shape the road to the majority in the House in either direction. A couple of biggies. You have CA 41, which is Republican incumbent Ken Calvert down in the Palm Springs, Riverside County area. He's been a 30-year incumbent. He faces Democrat Will Rollins, who's a former federal prosecutor. That district has become very purple. You have sort of the cultural split between the Palm Springs area and more conservative areas of Riverside County. That's if that is perhaps the most competitive. And then you have over in the Santa Clarita, sort of northern LA County area, you have incumbent Mike Garcia faces a very tough incumbent Republican Mike Garcia faces a very tough challenge from Democrat George Whitesides. George Whitesides is a former NASA official and has self-funded a large portion of his campaign, and he's actually outraised Garcia already. That's another race where Republicans are really investing. Those are a couple of the biggies. The other one I would highlight in Orange County, the seat that is currently held by Katie Porter, it's open since she ran for the Senate and did not make it through the primary in that race. You have Democrats, David Min, he's waging a very tough campaign with Republican Scott Baugh. That's another very, very tight one. It's kind of a suburban Orange County district that is often seen as sort of a bellwether for where California is going to go and where ultimately maybe the direction of the House is going to go.
Yeah, I was just going to say that because these districts are key not only for California, but the state could actually be a tipping point for congressional control.
Yeah, absolutely. If you take the half dozen closest races in this state, it really, really could come down to this if it's tight in other parts of the country, especially.
In the upcoming election cycle, of course, there's another group that's facing a tough road ahead. And this is pretty interesting. They're progressive prosecutors, particularly on the West Coast. Where is that backlash coming from and how is it playing out here in California?
Yeah, it was really just a couple years ago that we saw this kind of a wave of progressive prosecutors come to power in major cities on the West Coast, in Los Angeles and Oakland and Portland, San Francisco. But what we've seen very consistently over the last year or 2 years is that those progressive prosecutors are now facing serious headwinds due to public concern, public perceptions of crime, rising crime in some areas, other areas really more just concerns about the perception of crime. And voter frustration of people feeling like that law enforcement hasn't been fast enough to deal with post-pandemic challenges in urban centers. Just last week, Mike Schmidt, progressive prosecutor in the Portland area, he lost an election to a deputy prosecutor in his office who was a former Republican. That sent shockwaves through the progressive criminal justice community. And this, came just a few years after Chesa Boudin lost the recall election for district attorney in San Francisco. And he's been replaced by Brooke Jenkins, who is a more sort of law and order, tough on crime prosecutor, a tough on crime Democrat prosecutor. But it's not, not just those two cities in Oakland, Alameda County area. We have Pamela Price, the DA there, is facing a tough recall election. Down in Los Angeles, George Gascon, the DA there, is facing a tough election in November. So really all this whole generation of progressive prosecutors is facing strong headwinds, and they're all either facing challenges or they've been ousted at this point. So it's very much a sea change for that that environment. A couple years ago, after the killing of George Floyd in 2020, there was so much attention to justice reform and discussion of racism in law enforcement, and this very much seems like a pendulum shift away from that trend that we saw.
In the last minute or two that we have, I do want to move to college campuses because unionized academic workers at several UC campuses are striking, including UC Davis starting today, over allegations that university leaders violated free speech rights of student protesters who oppose the Israel-Hamas war. We also had last week outgoing UCLA Chancellor Gene Block testified before a Congressional House Committee about his handling of a pro-Palestinian encampment as well as anti-Semitism on campus. What is the political impact of all of this?
The fascinating piece of it is that it's hasn't been a red and blue thing. You've even seen Democrats in the state legislature, progressives, including Assemblyman Rick Zabur, a progressive Democrat. He's been among those calling out some of the campuses here, including UCLA, over how they've handled reports of anti-Semitism. And so I think, there are factions within both parties that have had that concern. And it is kind of, if more than anything, it illustrates a split within the Democratic Party, I would say, where you have the more traditional mainstream wing of the party raising concerns about the way UCLA and other campuses handled some of those responses to protests. But then you have more progressive factions within those parties that are really pressuring the mainstream leadership of the party over that issue, and they want to see more pressure around ceasefire efforts, divestment efforts. And this comes as Israel continues to come under more scrutiny, especially in recent days, over the killing of people in refugee encampments in the southern part of Gaza. So yeah, I think it really more than anything illustrates that tough rift that Democrats are trying to navigate within their own party.
Dustin, as always, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dustin Gardner is the co-author of Politico's California Playbook, and we've been getting an update on the latest in California politics. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.